Hello, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program on CBC Radio 1. Featured on today's program, what do statistics, bonobos, and Neil Armstrong have in common? They're all the subjects of new science books on our holiday book special, starting with the odds of getting even.
If someone's shooting craps, let's say, and they're hot, they've won 10 in a row, right? Then some people think, oh, that guy's on a roll. He's almost certainly going to win the next time. Other people think, oh, he's had his run of luck, so now he's due for a fall. And they're both wrong.
Plus, sex in the forest.
Bonobos are sort of the primate hippies, you know. They make love, not war. Or in the wild, if they enter a fruit tree and so there's a potential of a lot of competition, they will have sex instead of competing, and then they share the food.
And first book about the first man.
Once the Apollo 11 mission was complete and Neil was first man, Neil Armstrong became a global icon. Cultures, societies all around the world wanted to project their own belief systems and their own story onto Neil's story. They wanted to be part of it.
All this and more today on Quirks and Quarks. Ever bought a lottery ticket? Come on, fess up. If you haven't, I bet you thought about it. The lure of millions of dollars is hard to resist, even though we all know our chances of winning are incredibly small. And according to a new book by Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal, if we paid more attention to statistics, we'd live richer, fuller lives. We'd know whether to take the bus or walk to work when we're late, whether it's safe to fly the day after a plane crash, or why it's no big surprise when two people at a party share the same birthday. Dr. Rosenthal is a professor of statistics at the University of Toronto and the author of Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you very much.
Now, I got to tell you, as somebody who doesn't deal with mathematics very well or statistics, this was a great read because you brought it into everyday life and amazing how much mathematics is actually involved. So let's take this one example of I'm at a party. So what are the odds of finding two people with the same birthday?
Right. So this is one that that surprises a lot of people. So, of course, it depends how many people are at the party. But suppose, let's say, there's 40 people at the party. Well, you think, you know, there's 365 days in the year and 40 people, that's not that many. So probably there won't be a match. But the thing is, with 40 people, there's an awful lot of pairs. You know, you can have A paired with B or A paired with C or A paired with D or B paired with C or B paired with D. And when you start putting it all together, it turns out there's many more pairs of people than there are actual people. And with just 40 people at a party, there's almost a 90% chance that some pair will have the same birthday.
Oh, go on. That's not just a coincidence?
No, it'll happen with probability almost 90% if you've got 40 people. And it's a fun way if you're at a party, you want to make a little money, you know, offer someone a little bet. And it's really true. And it's related to other things which are sort of more important than just making a bet at a party, because often we notice certain coincidences, right? We say, you know, let's say that five people were murdered in the same week, or we notice that, you know, you're playing a game and everybody works out the same way, and you say, ooh, there must be some special force involved. But the answer is there isn't. That a lot of coincidences can be explained, just like the birthday problem, by saying that because there's so many possibilities for it to happen, that's why it'll happen sometimes by pure chance.
Well, what's the mathematical principle that's involved there?
Well, as I say, the best way to think about it is how many pairs are there. So if you're thinking about the birthday problem, think, you know, even let's say there's just four people at a party. Well, there's already six pairs of people because there's A and B and A and C and A and B and V and C and V and D. And when you put that all together, you say, well, the more people, the more pairs. And the number of pairs goes up roughly like the square of the number of people. So the more people, the way more pairs there are.
Okay. Well, one of the main themes in the book is something you call the law of large numbers.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Right. So that's the idea that things which just have a slight edge in the short run will always work out in the long run. So the best way I think to think about it is in terms of casinos. So suppose you're playing, let's say, the game of craps. So we all know the game of craps. You keep throwing these two dice. And turns out the probability of winning at craps, the rules were chosen just right. So you have about a 49.29% chance of winning. So in other words, it's just barely less than a 50-50 game. So any one person who goes out and shoots craps, they might get lucky. They might win a lot of money or they might lose a lot of money. But the law of large numbers says that if you play lots and lots and lots of times, over the long run, because it was just less than a 50-50 game, over the long run, you're going to lose money. And from the casino's point of view, since there's so many people playing so much crap so much of the time, that the casino always makes money. And that's why you think, you know, how could it be there's all this randomness of the dice, but the casino is raking in, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and it's making revenue for the government and so on. How could that be? Well, it's the law of large numbers, which says this tiny, tiny advantage they have on each bet really in the long run becomes a sure thing.
But I'm surprised that the odds are that good in a casino. I thought that it was really leveraged very heavily in their direction. Would you say it's almost 50-50?
That's right. Well, it depends a little bit on the game. And the reason I chose craps as examples is because that's the closest to 50-50 of the standard games. But they're all just a little bit less. And the reason the casinos do that, the casinos are pretty smart, and these things have been developed over long periods of time. And they realize if you always lost every bet, people would stop going to the casino and they wouldn't make money either. So the best way for them to make money is make it pretty close to 50-50 so enough people win that it seems fun and it seems exciting, but make sure it's just under 50-50 so in the long run the casino gets all the money.
So how do you think people could improve their daily lives by paying more attention to statistics?
Yeah, well, often people react, for example, out of a fear of something or a hope of something when it might not be that rational. So, for example, a lot of people might say when they hear about a terrorist attack, they think, oh, I'm going to be next. The terrorists are going to get me. It's only just a simple check of, well, you know, how many people were living in that country compared to how many were actually killed by the terrorists can mean not to minimize the issue at all, but to say that the odds that I'm going to be killed or that one of my loved ones is going to be killed could be very, very low. The other side of the coin is, well, you mentioned, for example, lotteries at the beginning, and a lot of people will think, well, you know, I think I'm going to win the jackpot. You know, there was about a month ago, there was this great big $40 million guaranteed jackpot, and people said, you know, I think I'm going to buy tickets because I think I'm going to win. Well, the answer is, you know, you can just compute the probability, and the chance of winning the lottery is so small that it's actually just inconceivable. So one example I give in the book is if you drive across town to buy a lottery ticket, you're about twice as likely to die in an automobile accident on your way to the store as you are to win the jackpot. So sometimes just a little bit of a perspective, what I call a probability perspective on what the odds are, it can actually go a long way.
Well, what about, other than lottery tickets, what about everyday things like whether to take the bus or not or what route to take if I'm going to go to work?
Right. So often, again, people react out of, you know, oh my gosh, you know, the bus might be late. What should I do kind of thing? And I would argue that a good way to think about it is just get a rough sense of the probabilities. You say, well, you know, the bus is usually on time, but maybe one chance in four is late. Okay. Then say, well, what are going to be the consequences of if the bus is on time or late? So if you've got a really important meeting, then maybe that bus being late is going to be a disaster. But if you're just meeting some friends in a bar, maybe the bus being late won't be such a big deal. And you can combine that all. So there's something called the utility functions, which is a way to assign the how you feel about the outcome, how bad or how good the different outcomes will be. And when you combine that with the probabilities, you can get a sense of whether it's a smart move to take the bus or it's better to get a taxi or it's better to walk. You can just get a rough sense of things just by considering the probabilities and the possible outcomes. And not that, you know, you're going to do a careful calculation every time you get on the bus, but just having a bit of a perspective on that, a bit of a sense of, well, if the bus is late, how bad will it be? And what's the probability of it? Just a little bit of a sense of that can go a long way, I think. And I find I can, you know, it's not that I always make the perfect decision, but I at least have a framework for making decisions other than just sort of a panic.
Well, I'm curious how you made the decision to come here to the studio.
I came on the streetcar because, of course, the TDC is the better way, and I believe in that. And also, yeah, I guess if you drive, then, you know, there could be traffic and you might have trouble parking and all these kind of things. So I thought there was a little less uncertainty that way.
Very good. Well, we certainly see statistics quoted all the time in newspapers and the media, especially around this time where there's a federal election coming up. How should people interpret the polls that they see in papers?
Right. Polls are very interesting. So at their best, polls are actually, I think, our greatest expression of democracy because they, you know, they get the people's opinion in a way that an election with all the chaos and all the multitude of issues and personalities doesn't really do that. So, for example, on an opinion, if you say, you know, how many people believe such and such? Well, a poll in theory is the best way to do it. Now, polls have a lot of problems in practice. So there are certain problems that, for example, depending on who's running the poll, there could be some bias in the way the question is phrased. You can make the same thing sound like a really good idea or a really bad idea just by how you phrase the question. But also there's problems that, for example, not everyone will respond to a poll. Some people won't even have a telephone, or if they do, they'll refuse to talk to pollsters. Or they'll, you know, they'll have an opinion, but they won't tell the pollster, or they'll lie to the pollster because they're embarrassed about their opinion. So there's all kinds of ways that polls can get the wrong information. So you have to be very careful conducting them. But then there's also a question with polls, and this is the most interesting really from a probability point of view, is what's the margin of error, right? So we all hear about, oh, that's accurate to within 3.1 percentage points, 19 times out of 20, and almost no one knows what that means, right? So,
that's right.
So what does that mean? So that's one of the things I talk about in the book, and I say, well, to understand it, you can think of, for example, if you're flipping coins, and say, well, if you flip just a few coins, then you won't get half heads, right? You might get all heads, or maybe you get two-thirds heads or something. If you flip a lot of coins, you're going to get closer and closer to having half heads. So, for example, if you flip 1,000 coins, you'll get pretty close to having 500 heads. And it turns out the percentage of heads, it won't be exactly 50%, but usually it will be within about 47% and 53%. And that's a way of saying that, well, the margin of error is about 3% if you flip 1,000 coins. And it's the same as saying if you sample 1,000 people. So the margin of error, it's not saying how close you are to the true answer because of all these things about people lying and not showing up and not answering the pollsters. But what it is saying is how close you would be to the result you would have got if you'd sampled everyone in the country or the province.
Oh, I see. So it's saying that you're generally in the ballpark.
Saying you're generally in the ballpark of what everyone would have said if you called everyone. That still may not be the true answer, and opinions can change and so on. So it's good to understand. And also, I mean, for your more mathematical viewers, one neat thing is that the margin of error, it actually has got a really simple formula that nobody knows either. But if you take 98% and divide by the square root of the number of people that you surveyed, that's the margin of error.
Oh, great.
And all these newspapers make it sound like a big mystery, but it's actually that's all there is to it.
It's funny, though, how I get a reaction like that. As soon as you start mentioning a mathematical formula, there's something in my brain that just turns off. I mean, do you find that some people just can't deal with numbers?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of people who have sort of, you know, fear of math. It's sometimes even called math anxiety, right, or this feeling that, oh, I don't want to see any formulas. And one thing I tried really hard to do in the book is to make it accessible to even people who don't have any math background, because I really do believe that without getting into all the formulas and so on, you can still get a perspective on probabilities. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's one thing that as mathematicians we're always up against is people say, oh, you know, I was never good in math. I don't want to talk about it even the tiniest bit.
Well, you do cover a lot in the book, but one of the examples is a program that I used to watch a lot as a kid, and it was, it's still on the air, Let's Make a Deal. It's the Monty Hall problem, where you have three doors, you got to choose the one that you had. So take me through that. How does this work?
Right, so the Monty Hall problem was actually, it was just a modification of the actual TV show, but it was proposed in a magazine and became a huge, everyone was fascinated by it. So the way the setup is, it says there's three doors, and behind one of the doors, there's a car, and you're the contestant. You're trying to win that car, and so you get to guess one of the three doors. And say you say, oh, I think it's behind door number one. Okay. But rather than tell you if you're right or not, what the host does, he says, well, let me open another door. And the host, let's say, opens door three and says, see, the car wasn't behind door three. Now, do you want to stick with your original guess of door one, or do you want to switch to door two? And so most people say, well, you know, how does it matter? It was equally likely to be behind any door. What difference does it make? But it turns out you're actually twice as likely to win the car at that point if you switch to door number two.
Really?
So most people find that really surprising, and there's different ways to think about it. One way to think about it is, well, in the first place, if you were right, you had one chance in three of being right in the first place, and in that case, you want to stick with your original choice. But if you were wrong, then the host is going to open one of the other doors which doesn't have the car, but the door that the host didn't open, that's the one that has the car. So in other words, whenever you were wrong with your first guess, you'll be better off switching, which is actually a probability of two-thirds instead of one-third. So it's one of these funny little puzzles that it's part of what we call conditional probability, and it sort of says, well, turns out even though you thought it was equally likely, there's a two-thirds chance of winning if you switch.
Do you play games like that? I mean, do you go to casinos? And
I don't go to casinos much because the problem is, of course, I know the odds. I know the law of large numbers, so I know that in the long run, it's against me. So I sometimes enjoy watching other people at casinos, but I don't really enjoy betting at them. But I do enjoy other games, you know, games that involve chance, you know, like whether it's playing poker with friends or playing Monopoly and so on. And I do like thinking about, you know, the dice and the cards and the probabilities for sure.
Do you win?
I'm pretty good. I try to apply my probability knowledge to some extent. Of course, one thing about applying probability knowledge is it's never a sure thing. It's just saying, you know, I can arrange it so I have a little bit better chance of winning than somebody who didn't have that knowledge. But it doesn't mean I'm always going to win. And that's one of the reasons I believe in the law of large numbers. I think, well, over the long run, I'm going to win more than the other guy. But it doesn't mean I'm going to win every time. So,
do you actually, in your everyday life, do you use statistics and probabilities in just making ordinary decisions yourself?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, again, not every minute. You know, I do take time off, so to speak. But, I'm usually thinking, you know, whether it's, you know, am I going to, you know, hold a picnic outdoors? Well, what's the probability it's going to rain? Or, you know, am I going to, you know, apply for this, you know, grant? Well, what's the probability I would get it? And so on. So I am always thinking that way. One story that I talk about in the book is where I was flying to New York City, and it so happened I flew just 1 week after there was a bad airplane crash in the very same airport. And I thought, first, I was actually scared. This is back when I was a graduate student. I thought, man, you know, there was this big crash. All these people died. I don't want to fly to that same airport just 1 week later. Maybe I'm going to die too. And I had to say, okay, let's just stop and let's just check the numbers a little bit. And it turned out there were over 5,000 flights a week into that one airport. So even if I knew there was going to be another accident within the next week, which there was no real reason to think that, but thought, well, you know, that's a pretty small chance. So somehow I wasn't worried anymore. And I used to be kind of a nervous flyer, and now I'm not. So I think there's cases where it probably can help you like that.
And of course, if there was another crash, the odds of it happening at that airport again are even less, right?
Well, that's a good question, actually. In a way, that it's not that clear, but pretty much no. Like pretty much somehow, if you think of the crashes as being independent, then it would be, you know, the same probability whether there had just been a crash there or not. It's kind of like if someone's shooting craps, let's say, and they're hot. They've won 10 in a row, right? Then some people think, oh, that guy's on a roll. He's almost certainly going to win the next time. Other people think, oh, he's had his run of luck, so now he's due for a fall. And they're both wrong somehow. You know, each time you shoot craps, you've got that same chance of winning that 49.29%, whether you won the last 10 or you lost the last 10 or whatever.
Wow. what do you hope people will take away from this book?
Well, I hope people will see, first of all, that, you know, probability can be relevant and important in everyday life, and that they have, you know, a bit of a perspective, a little more perspective than when they started, about when things come up, whether they're, you know, scared about bad things or optimistic about good things or making decisions about what to do, that they'll think, well, you don't have to just, you know, freak out or just use your, you know, just panic, but you can think in terms of what are the probabilities and what are the possible outcomes. And if people come away with that understanding and hopefully find the book entertaining at the same time, then I'll consider my job done.
Dr. Rosenthal, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal is a professor of statistics at the University of Toronto and the author of Struck by Lightning, published by HarperCollins.